Well, hello again there, folks, and I'm back on the Morecast with a special guest. I've got Distributist on, and I thought it would be good because we've got war talk back in the news, and I've seen people in the mainstream kind of accusing people of being traitors and of treason, which I thought is very strange. It's sort of antiquated kind of language. It's not the kind of language we're used to hearing anymore, but it comes back in times of war, cynically as well, I would say. So I thought, I got to thinking, and I put a poll up on Telegram, sort of asking where people stood on this idea. And I saw that Distributist said he could answer it really, is it always morally wrong? And he answered it very easily. And I thought, well, it would be interesting to have a discussion about this. So good evening, Distributist. Are you okay?
Yeah, good evening. I just realized that I answered it very easily, but then I answered that treason is always wrong by definition, but then I drew a diagram implying otherwise because I didn't have a good word for treason that isn't wrong.
Yeah, it's because treason, if you commit treason just by the definition of treason, you've done something wrong.
It's like murder, right? Otherwise, yeah. It would be killing. But I don't know what the equivalent is, right? Like, you can't, there's no such thing as justified murder. A justified murder is a killing, right? Mm-hmm. It can be a justified killing.
It can be justified killing. And so then you would have to justify your treason. And this is where I think it gets interesting. But before we get into that, like, is it just me, or is treason, does it seem like an antiquated kind of language? Tony Blair actually scrapped the treason laws in Britain in the late 90s, I believe. And now I just think it's funny because when the sort of the new left was ascendant, they were wary. Then treason didn't exist. They didn't like the concept. They thought the concept was old-fashioned and stuffy. And it's as if now that they are dominant, they're going to kind of sneak it back in, because if they are all-powerful, then treason would imply treason to their ideology, the treason to the progressive world that they are in the process of creating. And I think this kind of bleeds into what we're seeing with the situation with Russia, and people like Vaush calling people traitors, and Richard Spencer calling people like Jimmy Dore a traitor's union of populists, and all of this kind of thing.
And they try this, but I don't think it really works. It's almost the equivalent of right-wingers calling the left-wing racists, right? It clangs. Have you ever had a genuine progressive call you a traitor? They do it, and then they immediately realize that they've sort of laid a, you know, they've given you a layup, and they immediately try to slink away from the accusation or end the conversation, or to digress to something else. Or if it's on the internet, they'll call you a traitor and then just sort of run away. They're not going to call you a traitor and then enter into a larger discussion of treachery and what's wrong with it. They're not prepared to have that conversation, and that's sort of what makes the progressives or the real racists so hollow for the right too. Sort of baked into the accusation of racism are concepts that are sort of diametrically cross to what they're diametrically opposed to what the right is. And the same thing for treason. If you really pull the thread on treason and treachery and why it's wrong, and you explore that in for any length of time, you'll immediately come to some conclusions that are quite anti-progressive.
Yes, I think if somebody accused let's say the Labour politicians in somewhere like Rotherham of being traitors to the people of that town, they really mean it in a really visceral way. But when the left accuse people of being traitors, they have to kind of do it in an ironic way, in a sort of cope way, which is comes across fake and inauthentic.
Yeah, we don't care about treachery, but you do. So if you don't do this, you're big hypocrites, right?
Yeah.
They're almost using it exactly the way that a lot of neocons used racism to try to say that Democrats were the real racist in America. And it just comes off as completely hollow and self-serving, which it is, because I don't think at the end of the day that, you know, I don't think at the end of the day that progressives believe that there is such a thing as treachery, because to imply that much would imply that you can have lasting bonds that can constrain an individual at a fundamental level, and possibly in a way that they cannot break by their own will. And this gets them into a discussion that they don't want to have. You immediately try to, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, this is absolute, you know, treachery is one of the highest crimes, but it's certainly not absolute. And I'm sure that's going to be part of the discussion. But in order to sort of separate good treachery from bad treachery, or the conditions under which treachery can rightfully occur, or can be said to properly occur. That's again, that sounds like a contradiction, right? Because treachery by definition is basically to describe situations where breaking the bonds of loyalty could happen in a proper way, is to basically examine what things are higher and which things are lower, and what things can properly constrain human action and what other things cannot. And that's a discussion that the leftist does not want to have, because it has some pretty obvious hierarchies involved.
Yes, I like the idea. Go on, sorry.
No, that was just finishing. I mean, these hierarchies are well established inside Western history, both pagan and not pagan. And you can see them come out both in Greek authors and certainly in Christian authors.
Yes, I like the idea that the left can't really they can't really pledge allegiance to anything higher themselves, because it would constrain the individual, and that they can't have that. So that's kind of like why it always comes across as fake to accuse somebody of being a traitor, because they're not really loyal. Because if they're loyal to something, then it kind of they're subservient to it. It's very interesting that
every now and again they toy with the idea that they're loyal to humanity. Who is that horrible Harvard professor, Noel Ignatiev? He was sort of the OG anti-white guy. You know, he famously came up with the term treason against whiteness is loyalty to humanity. And I'm always like, I always wanted to say, to borrow a leftist phrase, bitch, are you loyal to humanity? Really? Is this what this is about, loyalty to humanity? Like, we're all in it for the greater human race. And I've noticed this increasingly, is that I think in the late 20th century, the left was very comfortable saying that it was just loyal to the human race in sort of a Star Trek type way, in sort of an Independence Day, like if aliens invaded, man, you know, I'd be on the front lines. But I don't think people really believe that anymore. I think that the 21st century left would readily see the degradation of all humanity across all races if it increased individual autonomy and individual pleasure and their own political prospects. And this is not theoretical. I'm of the opinion that the left has pursued policies that have degraded all of humanity across all races for their own pleasure and their own political power. So, you know, I think that this is, you know, every now and again they toy with this idea that, oh, it's the UN, it's humanity, it's like these larger institutions. I think that's really to kind of cloud the distinctions between proper breaking of bonds and improper breaking of bonds.
Especially in Ukraine, when you've got, I certainly don't want to get bogged down in all the geopolitics of that, but just to pick that as an example, they're in this case like loyal to like neo-Nazi Azov battalion it's also cynical and self-serving that it's just loyalty to I mean, do you think the argument could be made that they are loyal to whatever advances them in terms of power?
Yeah, I think that's actually what's going on, right? Because it's pretty transparent that, I mean, again, you know, in the early 20th century, during the Woodrow Wilson era of leftism, and somewhat during the FDR era of leftism as well, there is this idea that leftism was actually this thing that was tightly bound to this particular version of nationalism, in which nationalism could be properly pursued within certain boundaries and within certain rules. But I mean, I think that was all lost in the late 20th century, during which the left said all nationalism is essentially bad. And the only good kind of nationalism is the nationalism that is in the process of abolishing itself, or nationalism that basically is making things politically difficult for a larger opponent of the left. And that's where you get to the Ukrainian nationalists, or the Ukrainian nationalism that's had a resurgence these days, or these last few weeks.
Well, I mean, one thing that jumped out at me when I was putting together a few notes and thinking about the discourse, where it is in regards to treason and traitors, is Lindsey Graham came out and said that he wanted to have somebody within the Putin regime assassinate Putin. And yeah. I thought this is funny because you can see that in this instance, how subjective this actually becomes, because that would then, if that happened, if somebody in Russia assassinated Putin, they'd be despised forever in Russia as traitors, like as real, the most venal backstabbing people. If they decapitated the regime in this, you know, serious hour of need, if you like, in a crisis situation, then that. But then, from Lindsey Graham's perspective and the American media's perspective, they would be hailed as heroes. And so there isn't like a firm definition of traitors and treason. This is what I think is very interesting about it.
Well, one of the characters that I have on my list of treason/traitors is, I don't know if you probably don't know about this person in Britain, but there is this famous American hero from the Revolution called Nathan Hale. He was, this is always sort of, and even me knowing about him was a little bit of an artifact of a previous era. Even when I got to school in the 90s, this character was kind of being phased out of American history, along with discussions over Benedict Arnold. It was kind of considered improper to talk about Nathan Hale as a hero or Benedict Arnold as a villain. And Nathan Hale was a spy who basically posed as a Tory school teacher inside occupied territory. I think it was either Philadelphia or New York, and reported back to the revolutionaries on British troop movements, which is, you know, absolutely being a spy. And he was caught and he was executed. And his famous last line was, "I wish I had more than one life to give to my country." And that's what kind of made him famous. I remember hearing the story of this great American hero and thinking, well, you know, if he had been the opposite, if he had been a spy reporting on American troop movements to the British, he would be absolutely despised. So, you know, I know he had a really great last line, but how is this, you know, how something didn't sit right with me, right? It was sort of this giant gray area. What I think is sort of vexing about treachery and treason is that it's considered to be one of the most grave evils in sort of the classic understanding of ethics. But at the same time, there are these very distinct gray areas.
Yeah. I mean, it's very, it depends on what. There's a very strong element of the history, the victors right in history. I mean, Oswald Mosley is, to mainstream Britain, Oswald Mosley would be regarded as a traitor. And then you have to think, well, what exactly was he a traitor to? And it's hard not to draw the conclusion that he was a traitor to the greater liberal sort of Anglo-American financial project. He would regard it himself that he wanted some kind of pan-European, not necessarily national socialist, but certainly fascistic. But he would see it in terms of sort of having a spirit of Europe. He supported a European Union. So he was loyal to Europe. It comes down to different visions of Europe. But then to say that, well, he was a traitor, it means that he lost. His side lost to the the war or the discussion. So then it became, well, now he's a traitor. But really, it's very it opens up all kinds of funny kind of worms like that.
It used to be, though, that, you know, at least before the 20th century, that there were these distinctions that were respected in terms of how people could break bonds of loyalty. So one of the characters, again, I had a list of characters that were kind of I was considering when considering how treachery is considered either bad or good. I guess there are sort of two components to it. The first one is exactly who are you betraying and for what reason? And is the reason higher or low? Is the loyalty that you're preferring higher or lower? And the second dimension is under what tools do you use to procure this treachery? And how do you go about doing this? How do you go about pursuing your treachery? So a classic example in the American context, not in the 20th century, very notably, is Robert E. Lee. So Robert E. Lee was a general for the American Army, what would later become the Union Army. And he was called on to serve as the commander of the American forces in the Civil War. And at the same time, he was called to lead the Confederate forces by his state, and he chose his state over his country. Now, I think that it was the way that he pursued this vocation of essentially leading a rebellion against the government of the United States really led, until very recently, caused Robert E. Lee's memory to be held as a memory of honor in certainly the South and some places even in the North, because he was considered to have conducted himself very properly. Mm. He sent back a formal letter of resignation and rebellion when he was requested to be the commander of the American military. I think I'm remembering that correctly. He did not accept his commission and then try to, you know, basically turn command his the men he was put in charge of to join Virginia. And after the war, first of all, he fought with uniforms. He didn't try to do something. He didn't use trust placed in him as the commander of the American military to subvert that military. He fought in uniform against it. And furthermore, and this is sort of the most important part of his legacy, is that after he lost his final battle at Appomattox Courthouse, he made sure that all of his officers and the people who followed under him knew that once they surrendered their swords and their uniforms, that was it. There wasn't going to be some kind of guerrilla warfare, some kind of Northern Ireland type splinter cells where the Union would constantly have to fight different localities in order to maintain its control over the South. And for that reason, he was considered always to be a rebel and not a traitor, even though, you know, quite arguably, he turned his back on a loyalty to the federal government that he had, you know, he had sworn an oath of loyalty to the government of the United States and had turned his back on it. But because the process of breaking that bond was sort of clearly documented and honorably followed, again, until very recently, until like 10 years ago, he was considered to be an honorable rebel rather than a traitor.
Yes, he formalized his allegiances. There was because treachery implies a kind of sleight of hand and a dishonesty, but he didn't. Let's have a look at this chart because it's very interesting, and I'm glad you made this. So at the top, we've got. It's such a fascinating subject. So at the top, we've got white treason, breaking bonds of loyalty for higher loyalty. So then you've got, is that Antigone?
Antigone, So I'm glad someone mentioned this character because all the other examples are Christian. And Antigone is so important because it shows you how it functions outside the Christian context. You know the Sophocles play or the...
No, I'm not familiar with it.
Okay, so Antigone was... So Oedipus... that's the famous king who was, he was cast out of his kingdom at a young age as a baby of Thebes. And then he returned later and accidentally killed this, you know, he accidentally killed this king who was fighting him. And he goes on to liberate Thebes from the Sphinx, who's this riddle-telling demon who prophesies that that by beating the Sphinx, he's going to commit great evil. And then when he gets into Thebes, he marries the queen there. And, you know, later on it's revealed that the queen is actually his mother and the guy he killed was his father. And this causes him to put out his eyes and wander the world as sort of an outcast. And his daughter Antigone goes with him. And this sort of completes a trilogy of Greek plays. And a curse is laid upon Thebes because of this incest that occurred at the high level. And the people who supported Oedipus and his family are defeated. And Antigone returns after her father dies to figure out that all her brothers are dead. And not only that, the new king says that they can't be buried. They're just going to be laid out and eaten by wild animals or whatever. And so Antigone decides to betray her city. And she goes out and she buries her brother by ceremoniously sprinkling dirt on his forehead. And this is, and again, she's executed for being a traitor. And the exploration here is that sort of Sophocles wants us to go on is that Antigone is not actually a traitor because the bonds of proper religious practice and of kinship are more powerful than those of nation and king. And the idea, once a king tries to usurp powers that are properly owed to the family and to the gods, then Sophocles certainly didn't use this term, but he sort of loses the mandate of heaven, and acts that are declared treasonous are no longer legitimately treasonous because they're overruled by a deeper and higher bond, both to the gods and to the family.
Yes. Yes, that's brilliant. And that brings us on perfectly to the next one, which was Thomas More, who it's not quite as bloody as that, but it's similar. So this is in White Treason, where it's the least worst. And you could say it's not that bad at all because they're loyal to a higher ideal, as Thomas More was. Funny enough, I discussed this with my dad today. There was a family get together. I know there's an anecdote about his beard as well, where he said his beard deserved to be taken away from his neck because his beard had done nothing wrong.
because he grew it while he was in the tower, I take it. For the audience, Thomas More was very famously the chancellor who refused to side with King Henry VIII. In his quest to put away, was it Catherine of Aragon? Yeah, it was Queen Isabella's daughter. I think her first name was Catherine, right? And Mary, and Mary Elizabeth I's first mother, who was Anne Boleyn. And so he to do this, King Henry VIII created a new church, and this is something that Thomas More felt was just a bridge too far, and so he remained silent. And basically, Henry VIII had him executed on what most people still, 500 years later, think are trumped up charges. It was based on the testimony of one person after it was really obvious that Sir Thomas More had taken great lengths to remain silent on the subject of the legitimacy of the Church of England. And he was executed, and his final words were, "I go to my death, the king's loyal servant, but God's first." And
yes,
I don't know. He's obviously a hero to Catholics, but I don't know a single Anglican who considers Sir Thomas More a traitor.
Well, yes, because I think it raises an issue about the legitimacy of the king. If the king is going to overrule God, then all of a sudden that puts the clergy in a very difficult position. And this is exactly what happened with Henry VIII.
Yeah. Well, also you'll see a commonality in Thomas More and Antigone, which is that they go to great lengths to make sure that their treachery or treason or white treason, or I don't know what to call this thing that is not an implication that it's something that it's not, right? But they go to great lengths to ensure that their rebellion is non-disruptive to the political order in which they live. They make it very clear that they're not trying to unseat the political order. For instance, Sir Thomas More remains silent on the subject of the Church of England and Henry's marriage to Anne, because he understands that a public proclamation would be equivalent to encouraging rebellion, which would be, you know, and because if he says like, oh, the Church of England is illegitimate, the marriage is illegitimate, he's basically saying that there should be a pretender to, and, you know, the War of Roses could easily resume, right? Because there were 1,000 pretenders back then. Mm-hmm. And, well, I mean, not 1,000, but there were quite a few. The throne was far from being stable at that point in the British monarchy. And that's one of the reasons why he was so widely supported in doing this. But you'll see a lot of this. And I also list here the Diocletian Christian martyrs. And then this is a joke. I have a Warhammer 40,000 character.
Yeah,
because I knew you've read the Horus Heresy books, so I just stuck one onto the end of the list.
It's depressing, but and I knew about Sir Thomas More, but I actually knew more about Garvey, Logan, and Warhammer than I do about Antigone. And it's really, and I'm just going to say it, I'm just going to be honest about that. But it is embarrassing, and it is one that you have to self-improve, and you have to constantly read and learn more about these things, because it is quite shameful when you know more about Warhammer than Antigone. I did know a fair bit about Sir Thomas More, though, so. But I don't actually know much about the Diocletian Christian martyrs. I think we actually discussed them a while back. So I was a little bit educated on that, but
there are two. So when it comes to Christian martyrs, there were two big Roman persecutions. The first one, which is a little harder to track, was during the time of the Judeo-Claudian emperors, and most Christian tradition put this really at the hands of Nero, who was the last of the Judeo-Claudians. Sometimes Caligula, because he's a popular punching bag, being crazy, but that's a lot less well established. And but by the time it gets to Diocletian, which was hundreds of years later, we have like really good documentation of all these martyrs. So there was an attempt to sort of rid the Roman Empire of Christianity in the reign of Diocletian, which was one of the emperors right before Constantine. And so these were largely, you know, I guess if tradition is to be believed, then the Neronian executions were very grand spectacle affairs, right? They were being done with people getting fed to lions and lit on fire and stuff like that, right? The Diocletian persecutions were much more of the let's do this on the lowdown type thing. So whereas the Christians kept records of their martyrs, this was basically just the state trying to get rid of a religious cult they didn't like. And they were much more extensive during this time as well. So I listed this one just because it's the classic example. Christians were not trying to overthrow the Roman government, certainly not at this time. It was not a political force. And I'm sure there's going to be somebody who's going to come in here and I'm actually this. But classically speaking, a lot of people think that Diocletian was treating the Christian populations as scapegoats for manifest declines of the Roman Empire, which is sort of entering into its terminal phase after having gone through 200 or 300 years of effective military rule under the the military emperors that followed Nero.
I mean, it raises an interesting question, something of a curveball here, because from the perspective, if you're a pagan emperor in Rome, and you look at the growing Christianity movement, religion, you do actually have reason to fear their loyalty, because if they are loyal to God and not to the emperor, there is a good chance that they are going to overthrow you eventually. And then where would the... So if there was a movement within the Christian community in Rome, let's say, or whether anywhere, it doesn't matter, and they were planning to overthrow the standing emperor and create what in effect would be a theocracy or a Christian Charlemagne type empire, like, so where would your loyalty fall then? Would it be to back the pagan emperor or to back the sort of ascendant Christianity?
Yeah, this is sort of my compromise as a political realist and as a Christian, is that exactly what you just said was going on. By the time Diocletian became emperor, belief in pagan deities was just dead as a doornail. And the sort of motivating religion of the city of Rome was just dead, couldn't be revived. And it was very obvious that in order for there to be new life, it would have to come through one of the new religions. And the new religions were Christianity, Mithraism from the East, and then various forms of Greek Gnosticism, and then remixtures of those three things. And it seemed, and again, this is me projecting my modern sensibilities onto these people that lived, you know, 1700 years ago, but it seems that the Diocletian's attack on the Christians was sort of this cathartic vengeance against sort of living cultural tissue, because he knew that the substrate of his own society was dying or dead.
Yes, it's interesting. But I mean, still, the question of loyalty. So who should have Christian of back then, the emperor or Christianity? Christianity, wouldn't it? But by implication, that means they're intruding. Like, I think rather than it being like an emergent force, like if there was actually a plot.
Well, there was a plot. Well, I mean, the reason why Christians were persecuted was that the way that the emperor secured loyalty was by essentially putting forward his own cult as a god, and then forcing ceremonial sacrifices, sort of meaningless ceremonial sacrifices to Caesar, with the implication that, you know, we don't really care if you believe, we just want you to comply. It was a compliance religion, right? And this is something, this sort of compliance without belief was something that other religions, including, I think, again, I'm going to get, I think some rabbinic forms of Judaism were fine with this too. But this sort of compliance without belief, bend a knee, was something that other religions could do and Christianity could not. And this is what got Christianity consistently in trouble. And, you know, that and this ridiculous idea that Christians were cannibals. And, I think that was transparently false even in the first century. But, you know, this is the standard propaganda that they put out. And I think that this rule was constructed to persecute Christianity, but it created a system in which Christianity was specifically the only religion that was persecuted because they couldn't comply with this directive.
Very, because it seems that they're walking a very fine line there in terms of the power structure and the makeup of the empire. It's a dicey one. And then, I mean, Gavia Logan, of course, is a bit more of a lighthearted one, but he is, he is in the inner circle of a top legionaries, Astartes, of Horus Lupercal, and he kind of witnesses, we get to see the turning of Horus. So this is in White Treason, which is breaking bonds of loyalty for higher loyalty, for a higher ideal, if you like. And so Gavia Logan's higher ideal turns out to be with the emperor and humanity over Horus. I mean,
he has directly sworn an oath to Horus at that time, and I believe Abaddon calls him a traitor.
Yeah,
if memory serves me properly, right?
Yeah. When the problem is, relative to them, he is a traitor, but they are themselves the real traitors. So
yes,
he gets a pass on that one.
And then which would be the claim of every one of the people in this category, right? Every one of the people in this category, when they're accused of being traitors, would say, "No, you're a traitor. Like I'm loyal to that power above you." And you can see sort of the boundaries come down too. Like there's boundaries that shouldn't be crossed. You know, kings should not ever try to compel religious belief or prohibit the piety towards family. And kings know that they should tread lightly on these grounds for fear of tyranny.
It's interesting that so this is white treason, and if we move to grey treason, just some of the some of the ones that I came up with as well on this, I deliberately chose figures on my list of kind of troublesome traitors, the ones where let's say Oswald Mosley or somebody like that, where you can kind of say, well, was he really? What was he a traitor to? And so then you come more into nationalism, and you come more into kind of loyalty to political ideals. If you go here, we've got William Wallace, George Washington, Robert E. Lee, Nathan Hale, and then Magnus the Red, and it's more like it's people trying to do the best in a fallen world, or they've got loyalty to a people or a nation more than a higher ideal, more than God.
Yes, and the thing is here is in the gray treason category, you're putting like against like, and you're operating in situations that are not ideal, but you're trying to make the best decision you can, I guess. So that's how I'd characterize each one of these things, right? And it's not clear to Robert E. Lee that his oath to Washington is more important than his oath to Virginia, right? That's not clear.
Yeah, an interesting figure, I think, is Colonel von Stauffenberg, who planted the bomb on to take out Hitler, basically. And the reason why I think that's an interesting one is because the timing of it. It's 1944, and he was a military man. And basically, Germany wasn't going to win the war at that point. And I think this is where it becomes very dangerous to sign an oath of loyalty to a regime and not say the nation as a whole, or the people, or God. Because then you're kind of bound and shackled to that regime to the very bitter end. And I can well imagine there's going to be a few kind of angry comments because I've said that. But here's the problem. If you look at it from von Stauffenberg's point of view, it's 1944, and Germany isn't going to win the war. So then you have to ask, well, what is the best outcome for Germany and the German people? Or is it that you should have more of this kind of Wagnerian Gotterdammerung, just go down all hell guns blazing, and loyalty to the bitter end in this kind of, you know, grand romantic struggle? And the realist kind of approach to that would be where the leadership has to go in order to kind of prevent prevent what happened in the end, prevent the Soviet army rolling in and raping everybody, or cities being incinerated and hundreds of thousands of people dying. Yeah. But at the end of the day, what he did do was an act of treason.
Yeah, and I definitely say that puts it in the gray category. It's very important to understand that von Stauffenberg felt very distinctly that he was assassinating Hitler for Germany. I think that was his last words, right? Where long live Germany.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Yeah.
You can see his motivations plainly there, right?
And he was a count. So he was more of the old sort of aristocratic Prussian class than the National Socialist cadres, which were kind of more modern and ideological. And, you know, as people often like to point out, some of them had more leftist backgrounds, and it was something new. It was something very much of the 20th century in a way that the old Prussian officer class weren't. And he certainly wasn't, by any stretch of the imagination, a liberal. And a funny thing is that the old Lee Marvin Dirty Dozen movie, like one of the missions they have, so this is like a 1960s view on this, and they, one of the storylines in the one of the Dirty Dozen is that they're aware that there's a high-ranking generals are going to kill Hitler, but they plan to actually carry on the war because they see that they can actually sort of carry out the war in much more efficiently and better than when Hitler was like incompetent and useless at war. And so they decide. So the kind of the Dirty Dozen, all of the scumbag special forces, they get sent in to kill the generals who are plotting to kill Hitler because it's better for the Allies if Hitler survives and carry on sort of making a mess of the war planning. And it's von Stauffenberg. I mean, they even had a Tom Cruise movie in Valkyrie. So you get to that problem again where they play down. When they do that, they very much play down that von Stauffenberg, he wanted a fully militarized Germany. He didn't want to turn Germany into some kind of progressive, liberal, happy capitalist thing. He wanted the army in charge. And he saw that the complete destruction of Germany would mean occupation. So this is another element to it, sort of thinking long term. You bump off the leadership before you just get completely brought to your knees. But you know, I can well imagine many people in the right wing would see him as a traitor. He was a traitor to a kind of heroic struggle.
Well, I mean, the thing is with von Stauffenberg, what puts him in the gray area, and definitively not the white one, is that his means were treacherous, right? He used tools that were only available to him because the state had vested him with powers. If he had defected or created alternative military units, I guess the argument from his point of view that would be much less effective and would probably just further the bad end of Germany that he didn't want, because it wouldn't stop Germany from being destroyed with Adolf Hitler at the helm. But at the same time, you know, this creates this gray area where, you know, it's very plausible that he had a higher loyalty here. But it will forever sort of be besmirched by the way he went about it. And yeah, I think we'll see this again with people like Brutus and Cassius too, right? But
I was just going to say it is at the end of the day the cowardly bomb in a suitcase under a table. It is. There's no way to make that sort of palatable, really.
Yeah, what you wanted, even if he did have to do it, is him walking into the room and just like drawing his sidearm and killing him, right, or something. Like if you know that would look better, certainly, right, as opposed to this whole sneaky, you know, sort of pranked bomb, hidden bomb,
or doing a suicide job on it, because he got caught alive. He wasn't even there when it went off.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that also would have been, I don't know, again, it's always very hard to say, like, this is how you properly procure treason. But, the situation sort of forces us to think in that direction, right?
And it's another thing. It's very easy. It's very easy for me and you to sit and have a cozy chat about how these people in the most extreme situations you can imagine making these awful decisions about, well, do I betray the leadership in order to save the country, or is murdering the leadership like worse still? Like what? It's this horrible, fascinating, this is the gray zone, I suppose. And I know you've got William Wallace here as well.
Well, William Wallace is pretty much just, is more like Robert E. Lee, I think, right? He just basically had dual loyalties and he chose one. But the reason why I listed him is because I remember the movie, you know, with William Gibson, Braveheart. I think everyone's seen that movie, right?
Yeah.
But in that one, to sort of what I think, you know, if you were in Dante's time, Dante was well aware of William Wallace. That was kind of in the news, I believe. And to them, it just looks like to Dante, it's pointless fighting for a boundary that doesn't matter and for a distinction that shouldn't have a real difference because there's no meaningful difference between the two countries. It's just fighting for fighting's sake. You know, but in the movie Braveheart, I remember that to sell it to modern audiences, they invent this phony baloney thing where the British are like doing prima nocta with Scottish women. And, you know, which never happened. You know, that could have never happened in a highly Catholic society of like the 14th century or, you know, the late 13th century, early 14th century. And, but they had to give him this sort of definitive primary loyalty to make it not seem like he was just a Scottish nobleman who felt that his loyalty to Scottish noblemen was stronger than his loyalty to the English nobleman, right?
Yeah. And it's funny what you were saying with Dante, because if you basically they were fighting for their freedom, famously in like a bit of a corny line, but he was a Scotsman fighting for the liberation of his land. But is that then a pointless struggle in Dante's eyes?
Well, it's been ages since I've read this. There's a throwaway line in, I believe, the Paradiso that I think he refers to. That's thought to refer to Wallace and Longshanks fighting. And I think what he sees this as two Christian kings that don't have a good political reason to fight. And, you know, Dante is someone who believes that Christian kings have this greater loyalty to this notion of the Christian empire. This is something that's Dante was what's called a white Guelph, I think, which really means a Ghibelline, but he was temporarily embarrassed. And the Ghibellines believe that there was this, that Christ had sort of a dual mandate. And the second part of Christ's dual mandate was that a secular empire should rule all of Christendom and unify all Christian kings under it. And he saw this fighting along with other fighting in far off lands, right? This is very far away from Florence, as sort of a pointless one-upmanship. And of course, again, this is someone who's very far away from the conflict. I'm sure it looks very different in Scotland, but from an Italian point of view, these are just, complicating the entire picture of what should be the project of unifying all Christian kings.
I can well imagine from the Italian perspective, because at that time, you know, as Machiavelli is kind of expressed, it in that era, it was just all of these bickering city states trying to kind of get one up on each other. And it's possible that Dante looked at the kind of the friction between England and Scotland as being like something the same, where like even there, even on this rainy, miserable island, they're still at this petty squabbling, just like what we've got in Italy.
Yeah, I think actually it might be more like how a nationalist views the Ukraine-Russian conflict. You know, the emotion is that Dante does have, you know, Dante does not perceive the squabbling between Italian city-states as pointless. He sees it as part of a larger discussion over who will rule Europe, the empire or the church or some combination of the two. And Dante thinks that sort of a combination should rule. And, you know, sort of a distant like myself looks at Ukraine and Russia and says, like, a lot of good people are getting killed in this battle. But how does this materially answer the question of who's going to rule Europe, the EU or the constituent nations? And, you know, maybe I'm superimposing my own perspective on Dante, but I imagine that's how he would look at it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then we've got George Washington.
Well, yeah, this is, I don't know much to say about this one, but, you know, the famous, I mean, he's actually a very Robert E. Lee-like character. I would imagine he can just be qualified. I mean, I think Robert E. Lee modeled his career after George Washington, them both being Virginians.
So why is George Washington a traitor?
Well, he was a soldier in the Crown's army, and he led a rebellion. I mean, without George Washington, there is no rebellion of the 13 colonies. Once more, you can just basically copy and paste Robert E. Lee's reasoning onto George Washington because it's exactly the same. Virginia asked George Washington to fight, and George Washington thought he was a Virginian and not an Englishman. I mean, it would be like the EU asking, you know, you to fight against Britain or something like that, right? It seems kind of ridiculous.
It's just to touch on the Robert E. Lee question again, because are they taking George Washington's monuments down? Did he have Washington in America with all of that stuff going on?
Oh, yeah. They will eventually, obviously, right? I mean, it's just everyone knows they will. I mean, Robert E. Lee, people don't know this, but I don't think he definitely didn't have slaves. And the only way he owned slaves was that he inherited some property, you know, very late in life that included a plantation like thousands of miles away that happened to have slaves on it. But he was not a slave owner in any specific sense. And Washington and Jefferson both absolutely were slaveholders, very famously. And yeah, you know, like they literally were slave masters, unlike Robert E. Lee. And so
yeah, I think Robert E. Lee has an association with the South that I think the progressives just do not like, regardless of whether he had slaves or not. And what's interesting is that in a way that so what you get is this, where Robert E. Lee sits in a reactionary camp, like relative to the liberal mainstream. And I think that plays into why I've never even been to America, but I get the impression that it's like they look at him not just in terms of the slave owning, but there's a political aura around him. And then you can also say that, well, he was a traitor to the progressive cause. He was to modernity even.
Yeah, I mean, this is always the thing, is that Washington and Robert E. Lee had very similar views in the world. They had very similar roles. I guess one won and one lost. But more important than that, George Washington carried the banner of the progressive march forward, and Robert E. Lee was essentially pushing back on it, even if they're fighting for very, very similar reasons.
And then we've got Magnus the Red. That was a funny one to put in there.
I could have put Ulfarius here too, but there are in the Warhammer 40K universe, there are a few Primarchs whose treachery is born out of conflict, where they're loyal to the Emperor, but they commit treasonous acts because they betray the Emperor because they think it's necessary to preserve the larger Imperium. Mm-hmm. And this eventually leads to their absolute corruption. But Magnus is the one, because he famously breaks the Emperor's edict against psychic powers to try to forestall the real heresy coming.
Yes, and also to save his own legion from a weird disease that they'd been inflicted with, yes. which was from chaos. So it's like, There's a strong element in it, which is kind of plays into the general theme here of people in fiction. I think we're looking at real, like, historical examples here. I think a whole other conversation would be how this would be handled in fictional works. And when you get into fiction, there's much more of an element of people losing their way, of people being tricked into committing treason and becoming a traitor, because it has that tragic aspect to it. And you see that quite a bit. I mean, in my list, I had Jaime Lannister from Game of Thrones. So just briefly, he's called the Kingslayer. And I think it's I haven't read the books, but in the first few seasons, which were good television, I'm aware it turned out rubbish. You don't have to write a load of comment.
The first four seasons were great, though. The first four seasons were quite good.
And throughout it all, so Jaime Lannister's character arc is where we hate him in the first few seasons. He's just this despicable scumbag, tried to throw Bran Stark out the window, and he's in a way, he's responsible for everything which unravels. But then he's called the Kingslayer because the mad Targaryen king, he was his bodyguard, if you like that, the king, head of the king's guard. He was supposed to protect the king, and he stabbed him in the back. So he is hounded wherever he goes as being a traitor, as being somebody who was, the king's life was placed in his hands, and he literally stabbed him in the back, and he's despised for it everywhere. And it turns out in one of the scenes that gets celebrated from Game of Thrones, that the mad Targaryen king, so the Targaryens have this weird obsession and relationship with fire, and the mad king was planning to basically burn everybody in the capital city, in King's Landing. He kept repeating, just burn them all, burn everybody. And so that meant that Jaime had to either show loyalty to his king and watch everybody in the city be get burned alive, or kill him. And so you get the mad king problem. Of course, if you've got the religious aspect, like we discussed earlier, that's kind of taken care. If you've got God above the king, then the mad king problem, that you can much easily justify it. But if the king is like, you know, if everything ends with the king, he is supreme, then yeah, it runs into a bit of a hazard. And in the end, Jaime Lannister decided, well, he'll do for the common good, kill the king and, you know, take what comes his way, but the people are saved, but he is hated for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what makes him sort of from a black treasonous character to a gray one. And it's gray because of the fact that, like von Stauffenberg, the treason is committed under such egregious circumstances that something has to be wrong with it, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's very interesting. I mean, they tried to replicate it at the very end with Daenerys Targaryen, who actually did burn everybody, and then Jon Snow kind of stuck a knife in her heart. But for some reason, it didn't have the same impact as just hearing the story of Jaime's story, which was much more fleshed out. And you took you out of it because you thought, aha, so that's what really happened. When they tried to kind of pull that trick at the end, it just didn't work. It didn't work.
There are so many things wrong with that scene that you could probably do an hour video just pointing them all out. There are so many dynamic tensions that were just absolutely ruined. But yeah, that scene absolutely did not work. One critical thing is that the crime had already been committed by the time he killed her, unlike Jaime Lannister, who had a serious moral dilemma in his hands.
Yeah, I mean, many people have made hour-long videos talking about that scene.
Yeah, probably Critical Drinker has like three of them, I imagine.
Yeah, Morlan and all of this, yeah. So yeah, I think the great treason is the kind of the interesting one, and it does remind me of that video of yours that I really liked about, funny enough, about Game of Thrones and how it was different to Lord of the Rings, which I thought was a classic.
Yeah, I think Game of Thrones is going to be completely forgotten 10 years from now. No one's, it's going to be amazing that people are so obsessed with it, when it really turned out that what we were so obsessed about was, you know, three competently written fantasy books and 4 years of competent television with absolutely no conclusion or larger point. It goes nowhere. It kind of reminds me of Downton Abbey a little bit. Digression alert, but you know, Downton Abbey is this beautiful British upstairs downstairs drama, but it doesn't have any point, right? Like to watch Downton Abbey is to only realize that it's a lesser version of Brideshead Revisited, which did have a point, in my opinion, and did actually come to a conclusion and point to something that was broader than itself.
I've just before we move on, I've started reading a book called The Iron King, part of the Accursed King series by Maurice Druon. And I got into it because I literally did a Google search books like, I wanted to sort of give the heavy duty stuff a bit of a break and read something which was a bit more kind of intrigue and plot and things. And I literally did a Google search, books like Game of Thrones, and this popped up straight away. And I'm about 50 pages in, and I really like it. It's a great page turner. There's no magic in it, but there's a hell of a lot of exaggeration. And it's kind of set in the run up to the Hundred Years' War of England and France. Ooh. So if you're after a book which is like Game of Thrones, where you've got a lot of great characters and a lot of plots and intrigue and backstabbing, then I highly recommend The Iron King by Maurice Druon. I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
The historical fiction books always have this advantage.
Yeah, and he's really gone with it as well. He's really, it's like, yeah, it's good stuff.
I'll have to check it out. Yeah.
And so then I think we can move on to Black Treason, which is like literally the final circle here. This is as bad as it gets. These are the real real scumbags. So the Judas Iscariot. this is the final one. Like this is as bad as it gets. Judas Iscariot straight there. There's no
Judas Iscariot is not. Yeah, I mean, the thing with Judas is that as a literary character, he's not particularly interesting because on any plain reading of the text, he's just a straight up traitor. There's a debate over whether he betrays Christ for money or pride. With most Christian theologians, I think, saying that he betrays him for reasons of pride. But a few heterodox theologians aside, I've never heard a possibility that Judas Iscariot might actually be a sympathetic character in any way. And also, you know, critical in this telling is that Judas's betrayal can only be accomplished because of his intimacy with Christ, which is symbolized in the fact that Judas betrays Christ with a kiss.
That's despicable. Like,
he's I'll go and I'll kiss the man who is the one you are to arrest in the Gospels, which is, which I know the Gospels aren't literary, but if they were literary, it's always weird talking about this way. If they were literary, the visceral idea that somebody can betray another person with a kiss is just absolutely central to kind of linking that to the twisted nature of the act of treachery.
Yeah, it kind of passes into being downright evil. To give somebody a kiss as a sign of affection, and it's as if it's bastardizing a sort of genuine sentiment of feeling and caring.
Here's the love you've given back to me, and I'm returning it to you as hatred.
Yeah.
You know, I've transmuted love into hate, holiness into pride. You know, it's literal, and this is what you see in all of these cases of black treason. It's the lower being preferred to the higher.
Mm-hmm. So then we've got Cassius.
Cassius and Brutus, two in one. I should have just paired them up. They're the two main conspirators in the assassination of Julius Caesar. Interesting thing here is that the assassination of Julius Caesar, like Judas's Iscariot, is a real life event that, like the betrayal of Jesus by Judas Iscariot, is a real-life event that has been so literized that it's hard to distinguish the literary from the history. But it should be important to say here that Shakespeare, at least in his play Julius Caesar, tries to make a distinction between Cassius and Brutus. Cassius is the man who betrays Caesar for reasons of pride and avarice and politics. And Brutus betrays Caesar because he's a genuine believer in republicanism. And he believes that Caesar has betrayed republicanism. Real life fun fact, the main political opponent of Julius Caesar, other than Pompey Magnus, who was much more of a rival than opponent, but the main political rival was Cato the Younger, who was sort of a combination of Yukio Mishima and Ron Paul of the first century. He was this very principled Republican who eschewed all property, and he wore like this Greek philosopher's toga, and he was an anti-corruption person, and he was trying furiously to keep the Republic alive, even though it was obvious to everyone that the former of the Republic was essentially creating the very corruption that Cato fought against. And very famously in Dante's Divine Comedy, Cato the Younger is the only person that's pagan who's seen as being saved, or one of the few people. And that's because he's just recognized as being so principled. And strangely enough, to get back to it, Sir Thomas More is compared very frequently to Cato as well, in both his literary portrayals and during his life, I believe. And Cato's daughter was married to Brutus. So Brutus was there's evidence that Brutus was a true believer in republicanism. And so there was some debate, and Shakespeare portrays it this way, that Brutus he genuinely betrayed his friend Caesar because he believed he had a higher principle of republicanism. But again, it's the circumstances that just make it so bad. Not only had Brutus, was Brutus Julius Caesar's friend, Julius Caesar had also pardoned him once for his own rebellion earlier when he had fought against Caesar in war. So, Brutus had again and again tasted the mercy of Caesar based on friendship, and he used that mercy and that forgiveness as a weapon to kill his friend inside the very Senate chambers that supposedly were sacred to him, committing in that action an act of desecration as well, because the Senate was considered a religious function of Rome.
And rounded up a whole host of senators as well. But So Cassius is more self-serving and thus less interesting, because when you're just a scumbag, you're not as interesting as the person who has, at least in theory, conflicting loyalties, conflicting yes. ideals. But when you're just a dirtbag, there's not much to discuss there. It is what it is. As soon as you say Brutus actually was a Republican and he thought that Caesar was a kind of bringing in a tyranny, then you think, aha, so there's another side to this. But then the circumstances, like he still dwells in the lowest circle here of black treason and our chart because of the way that he went about it.
Yeah, and Dante's Inferno, Judas, Cassius, and Brutus are literally all in Satan's mouth being chewed, along with the arch traitor Lucifer himself. So, this is the distinction between Cassius and Brutus, really, I don't know if it's entirely a fixture of Shakespeare, but he is the most famous originator of this distinction between the people who were in it for themselves and the people who had who felt like they were making this betrayal for a genuine religious concern.
So I think because I know you love Dante, and I think an interesting kind of point to be made here, and I've certainly pondered this before, is that why in Dante the traitor is in the final circle, that's as bad as it gets. Why is he worse than somebody who murders a child, or a mass murderer, or a sexual pest, or a thief, why did he have this special kind of condemnation for the traitor above all else?
Well, the way he categorizes it, Dante, the way he explains it is the if you categorize the layers of hell into sort of four broad pieces. The first piece are what are called sins of incontinence. So this is just like, you have moral principles, but your animal urges just get the best of you, right? You can't not steal the cookie from the cookie jar. You can't not sleep with your neighbor's wife, right? Like you're basically been overpowered by animal inclinations. leaving aside the virtuous pagans, that's the least bad, right? Then there are people who are consumed by hatred, which is, Dante calls hatred out as a special kind of thing. It's an urge that's overpowering you, but it's a demonic urge that's overpowering you, right? And this is what he calls the sins of violence. And then the third layer is called malbolgia, rotten pockets. And he explains this and says that these are the people, all of the people who commit violence, who are overpowered by animal instincts, demonic instincts, are committing their crimes on the surface, and they're out in the air, and the people who are committing them are condemned during their lives. But the malbolgia, they're committing the deceit. They're committing their demonic hatred in secret. And so there's an act of deception on top of the sort of demonic hatred that makes it worse. That's it. That's Dante's explanation. And then the distinction between malbolgia and the last circle are that malbolgia, the deceit you're perpetrating, is deceit against people who have no good reason to trust you to begin with. And the final circle of traitors are deceit against people who have put their trust in you. Said like, I am giving you love, and now you're going to transform that love back into hatred, the way that Judas betrays Christ with a kiss. This is sort of controversial, because if you were to further break down the traitors, it would go something like traitors to family, traitors to nation, traitors to guests, and traitors to benefactors. Most Christians would sort of be on board with this, but the traitors to nation, this sort of gets you back into the gray treason category. Mm-hmm. And this is something that Dante has been widely criticized for by later Christian authors. And by later, I mean just a few hundred years later, not just modern Christian authors, but Christian authors that came after the Middle Ages, is that there's this sense that Dante confuses politics with religion quite frequently and quite liberally. And this leads him to kind of make this confusion and treason and miscategorize potentially rebels as arch traitors. And I hope I'm not misremembering this, but there's one example in the final of the final layer of hell where the traitor is punished in his temporal life by being basically locked inside with his family without food as a form of punishing him for his treachery. And he eats his own children. And the symbolism being used is that this is a person who's possessed by basically the crime of treachery has completely erased his own character and sort of rewritten it. Dante had this weird religious heresy where he believed that after the commission of an act of pure treason, a demon would literally take possession over your soul. To bring it to Warhammer 40K, the Dan Abnett steals this with his character of Fulgrim, who literally has it happen to him after betraying his best friend. But Dante actually believed that people who committed this crime would literally go through life as human demon hybrids, sort of demon princes, if you will. And this is absolutely not in keeping with any non-crackpot version of Christian theology, but it's kind of fun to consider. But that's sort of Dante's internal logic, right? Dante's internal logic are that, you are in essence your commitments and your principles and your loyalties. And once you betray that in an act of demonic spite, you kind of murdered your own soul. Right. And with the people who commit violence and deceit from afar, that commitment's not very strong. So although they're doing kind of the same thing, they're doing it to people who they have not just said like, I love you, and now I'm going to murder you with that love. To Dante, that's quite a bit different to just deceptively murder someone or betray somebody. who's far away from you, who never had reason to trust you to begin with.
I'm reminded of the way Peter Jackson opened the Lord of the Rings, the third movie, with Gollum, where Gollum he's fishing on a boat, and him and his little friend, they fight over the ring. It shouldn't happen. Gollum murders his friend and takes the ring, and that is his original sin, if you like. It wasn't like it isn't just that the ring corrupted Gollum, but it was the original act. He had to carry that with him forever, and even sort of hundreds and hundreds of years later, when he looks at himself in the water, his split personality. There's one half, the evil half, kind of torments him because he's a murderer, which is strange because by that time you can imagine that Gollum's killed quite a lot of people, but it's that original act, that original thing that sent him, that corrupted him, was the murdering of his friend who was placing his trust in him, who didn't expect to be killed that way. Maybe they could have a bit of a fight. Maybe they could argue over who should get to keep the ring. But to be murdered like that is quite something else. And it's very interesting the way that it doesn't go away. It stays with you. That's the beginning there.
Yeah, and that scene in turn reminds me of the passage from Genesis of Cain and Abel, which I think it's designed to kind of look a lot like, right? The two brothers, and one kills the other for this reasons of pride, right? Reasons of preeminence. Yeah, I think it's hard because it doesn't translate very well into our time, this understanding of treachery. But when you think of it, and when you think of how ancient people thought of what people were, you weren't an individual. You were your relationships. You were your commitment. And so as opposed to the modern conception of a human, where we're all these little boxes that are isolated from the outside world, the human of the ancient world or of the pre-modern world is more this plant with a network of roots that connect them to family, and that connect them to religion, and that connect them to nation. And so to essentially be a traitor is to cut away at those roots, or to poison those roots, and to essentially turn on the thing that gave you life. And you know, in Dante's imagination, you can cut some of them and come back if they're distant roots. And I think in the case of white treason, we see that in some cases you have to cut them if those roots have essentially choking out the more important roots or delivering poison to the body organism. But if you cut off your large roots without trying to essentially, without if you just cut the roots that link you to God and to family and to the friends who you have an oath of loyalty towards, you've in a sense murdered your own soul. This is apocryphal quote from Thomas More. It does not, unlike the "I go to my death, king's loyal subject, but God's first," which he actually did say. But in the play "A Man for All Seasons," the Thomas More character says, and this is something that sounds like he could have said, so it's not so apocryphal, right? It definitely has that feeling to it, right? That sort of high Catholic Tudor tradition. But he says, when a man takes an oath, it's like he's carrying his soul in his hands and giving it to somebody. And if he opens his fingers with weakness, he will never be able to recover it.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. I think it's been a great discussion. I'm happy to leave it there. Any final thoughts just on the, because I think we've covered so much. I think it's been a good talk.
Well, I actually have one to return to our original subject. Maybe this is not something you want to discuss here, but what do you think of this leftists turn towards the rediscovery of treason as something that's bad. Because I think this is a fascinating cultural development that cannot be understated in my own imagination, because the left, oh man, they need this. They need this so bad. They need us to respect the bonds of loyalty that keeps us loyal to them and not just afraid of their power. They know they need this, but they also know that they've destroyed their own power to wield this weapon at a very fundamental level.
Yes, it's always going to be, it's kind of strange, because it gets back to some of the things we've been discussing, because they are only ever going to command the respect that a tyrant commands, because it's always going to be that way. They're always going to be the mad king who everybody's just terrified of, some lunatic who, and you can see it now. It's kind of manifesting in foreign policy towards a great power in the world. This idea that you can just cancel Russia. It's just completely ridiculous, and it's so effeminate,
isn't it?
Yes, it's dreadful. Especially, I mean, I made a little meme where you've got like this shady, he does actually look a sort of Eastern European look to him, you know, not in an ethnic way, but in the sort of in the hairdo, which looks like it's like sort of the late 90s or something. Mm-hmm. And he it's this meme where he says, trade offer. I'd made this meme for my Telegram page, and it was like, I get the world's wheat supply, oil and gas. You get Pornhub, Twitter and Netflix. And it's because they're so detached that they live in this kind of postmodern bubble where they take the things that actually keep things running, they just take for granted. And mm-hmm. they think they can threaten that. They can think we'll take that away from the Russians. But the more fundamental things, of course, are wheat. They may not be very fashionable, they are important. Gas and oil and wheat are more important than Twitter and Netflix. And what I really think is interesting is that Russia will be a space where this kind of progressive global homo, it'll no longer exist in the biggest country in the earth. It's kind of like there's now an edge to it. There's an old Red Hot Chili Peppers song called Californication, and they speak to it, and they're talking about the Californication of the planet. And there's a little line in it where he describes California as being on the very edge of the Western world. So you get this impression, which everything else is just completely covered in this coating of Californication. And now we're seeing where actually there's going to be a huge gaping hole. It's not going to be nice for the Russians, but there's going to be a definite end to the empire, this big barren space called Russia, where they're not watching Netflix anymore. We've had that a little bit with places like Iran and North Korea, but now there's this big opening in it as well. And of course, this is against the logic, that the progressive logic, that in time we would all head this way. In time, we would all just embrace the transgenders and, all of this kind of shallow consumerist mindset. And it doesn't appear to be, like, it seems to have peaked.
It does. And I don't want to count my chickens before they've hatched. But, I think people could always see that this thing wasn't going to happen the way that the prophets of the 90s thought it would. And is this going to be the bump that sort of creates the inflection point for this sort of globalist religion? I don't know. I actually don't think that it's very clear that this is going to be the inflection point. But if it's not the inflection point, then it prefigures an inflection point that will happen in the future.
It's strange because it gets back to the topic of discussion here, where we're talking about traitors and sort of conspiracies and things. And I get the impression that the real neck on the chopping block here could very well be America's itself. Where, and I love my movie analogies, and I remember the Godfather, where what happens is you've got all of these the five clans are at war, the five families, and Sonny is in temporary sort of, he's the patriarch temporarily while the Godfather's in rest, he's been shot, he's recovering. They know that Sonny is a hothead, and so what they do is get the guy who's married to Sonny's sister, and he beats Sonny's sister up. So then Sonny goes around and he just brays him all over the street. He'd be in front of everybody, just absolutely, as should be the case. That's perfectly fine. If you're a brother and you have a sister and somebody beat the husband beats her up.
Yeah, but I think if it were Michael, right, he would have handled it differently. Right?
Yeah.
Because the thing is that this is another apocryphal comment from, but it, I think, again, it's like something someone, this quote is, it sounds like something they would have said, but it comes from the book John Adams, later turned into the miniseries, where Benjamin Franklin says, it's perfectly possible to chastise somebody in private for being an idiot. Afterwards, they might even thank you for it. But if you chastise a grown man, and this includes beating them up, in public, you're going to make them an enemy for life. Right? So if Sonny wanted to handle his family business, he should have beaten them up in private. You know?
Yeah, and
he probably would have learned his lesson, right?
Yeah.
But beating him in public, you know, he's never going to live that down, right? He's always going to be the chump that got his ass beat in public. So, you know, his only option is to declare war.
And what happens is other people have taken note of this. And so Sonny says, if you touch my sister again, I'm going to kill you. Yeah. So then what they do is set up the next one. So his poor old sister gets beaten up again. And this time Sonny goes along with the, he just completely loses the plot because he's already told him once. And of course he goes onto the causeway. He doesn't have his bodyguards with him. And it's a plot, and he's surrounded by all of these mobsters who just, they've got Tommy guns, and they just absolutely riddle him with bullets. Mm-hmm. And I look at the world stage, you know, and I look at America as being this kind of hot-headed Sonny character, and you've got all of these people, you know, the Chinese and the Russians and even the Indians, it appears, and the people, Bolsonaro in Brazil. And you do get the impression that America is seen as this hot-headed lunatic with all of these stupid progressive ideas. And it's kind of like quietly, you know, through sneaky backroom channels and diplomatic missions, they're kind of thinking maybe it's time to take the big guy out. Maybe it's all the same. And lo and behold, you know, America, well, we're going to kick Russia off this SWIFT system. And it seems that the Chinese have already been building on their own and this kind of thing. And so it's and as gee, if...
Would there be large populations in America who might see the Western banking system as a political tool aimed against them?
Yeah.
Maybe.
This other thing, I mean, this politicization of everything is a problem, because I remember a time when you get a bottle of Pepsi or you'd eat a Big Mac cheeseburger wasn't a political statement. So when that isn't, when it's implicit, I did a Substack article on this a while back where the American rebrand is just rancid. If I was an Islamic cleric or a communist dictator, I would have much more to worry from Marty McFly in Back to the Future than the new woke the Marvel movie or whatever's getting pumped out now, because it's much that kind of the America as it sold itself, it was appealing.
Yeah, like think WAP, right?
Yeah, everybody wanted to be because, you know, I mentioned in the article Rocky Balboa. So as a great the first Rocky movie as a great example of Americanism imposing itself on the world, but with a positive ideal, where, you know, you maybe you're from Mexico or maybe you're from Poland or somewhere. What you get with America, the American promise, is that if you work hard, you pay your bills, and you're a good person, you stand on your own two feet, you'll get ahead. You'll win. Everybody's a winner. That it's, you know. But what you get when it's the rainbow flag and nobody, that doesn't appeal to anybody. That doesn't have a kind of universal appeal to the world. So America's soft power has been deliberately sabotaged. It's even, you know, even if you want to step away from the, you know, we're right wing and it kind of irritates us, just purely on a kind of geopolitical level, the Americanism of earlier decades was so much more effective than what this woke stuff is now.
Well, there's one level to it, right? Which is the fact that the woke is just ugly, and there's nothing that can make ugliness beautiful, real ugliness, not just like apparent ugliness. There are many things that are apparently ugly that are subtly beautiful, but there's nothing that make ugliness beautiful. But at a deeper level, for myself, I return to the concept of the mandate of heaven, and this is the real thing, I think, that has caused the decline of the West is the fact that they have done certain things that all sovereigns know they shouldn't do, which is that, especially with this gay stuff, they've engaged in policies designed to explicitly attack the family cohesion and religious practice, proper religious practice of their own population. And in some cases, they've even announced explicitly that they're perfectly fine with the decline of their own populations if it advances their larger geopolitical ends. And any sovereign that announces this or makes communications to this extent has completely lost the mandate of heaven. And while I don't think that's sufficient to make pure treachery, you know, mandatory, except it does in some ways make rebellion mandatory for anyone who cares about the larger prospects of the human race or of the holiness of the species or even the survival of your own family and peoples. And given the right circumstances, it has to be opposed with the breaking of bonds. And I don't know, again, the question is, can the West ever regain the mandate of heaven in any meaningful way? And I think that that's what everyone is sensing. That's what China is sensing. That's what Russia is sensing. And that's also what makes sort of the nationalist reaction to Ukraine kind of difficult. I fully sympathize with the people of Ukraine. My grandparents, my father, they were victims of the Russian army. And I held no torch for incursions by the Russians into Eastern Europe. But the idea that this is somehow a nationalist fight, or that the Western propaganda that's trying to spin this as some kind of fight of nationalism, is anything other than cynical politicking at the ultimate expense of these higher ideals is kind of ridiculous.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, I haven't had much to say on it. I'm just amazed that it's called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Ukraine's very far from the Atlantic. I don't know, and even then they would have to understand that they were told explicitly by Vladimir Putin, I can't do this. I can't allow it on my doorstep. The missiles bases or the fact that they're joining the, I can't allow this. You have to understand. And they didn't listen. And you just think, why not? I don't know why they didn't listen and give up Ukraine. they had this drive. I mean, I saw Imperial Press had a post on Telegram today saying it, in a way, it's like the logic of liberalism that it can't leave anything alone. If your highest ideal is all of these human rights and the sanctity of the individual and everything, then it's as if you are on a mission. You can't, like, there's always another country which needs to have liberal democracy.
Yeah. I think it behooves distance to, in the West, to stay out of this. I would pray for peace. I would take any actions you can to procure peace, because a lot of good people are dying in this conflict needlessly. And but always keep in mind that this conflict is being driven by two very, very cynical sides of a geopolitical battle, and neither of those sides have your interests at heart. And so it's almost, you know, your responsibility is to make sure that your people and your children and your family are taken care of. Those are the people who put their trust in you. And that's what we need to be concerned about, not betraying implicitly, even of course not explicitly, as this discussion would outline, but that's what our priority needs to be. And in a lot of ways, for most people in the West, this Ukrainian thing and determining who is the lesser of two evils is just not a good way of thinking about this. If we do sympathize with the Ukrainians, we need to make sure that their country isn't a pile of rubble. Or not make sure, but we need to pray that it won't be.
Yeah. I mean, I want it to end as quickly as possible, even from the perspective of self-interest, because life's not going to be good when we don't get wheat anymore from Eastern Central Europe. That there's an element of that. But then I think what's fascinated me about it is just looking at what it says about our where we live, what it's the way that the how cynical it is, the way they can whip up this frenzy and get everybody into this state of this rage, and it's just so depressing by now, you know. It's how corrupt it is, and just like this idea that all of the kind of the superstructure of the West, which, as I mentioned before, when it was a Big Mac or a cheeseburger, a Coca-Cola, and that's all it was. It didn't have a political slant to it. Now, it's kind of like all of that's been activated. All of everything has been politicized, and like Skynet, it's just sort of been switched on, all to go hand in hand. These public-private partnerships, as they call it, I think it is. So it's all in lockstep, and it's terrifying because you see things that you'd never considered before can be politicized. We must live in the most politicized society that's ever existed.
Yes. I mean, I think that I would definitely compare this to probably what it was. I mean, we're entering into sort of the era of early Soviet Union, where, you send your kids to school, and it's all about how the Tsar was an asshole 20 years after the Tsar died, right? It's all of this kind of thing where politicization just inhabits everything. It doesn't feel sustainable. I think that it will eventually kill itself, and this is certainly a part of it. I mean, we're just trying to figure out where we're going to position ourselves in this. It seems like how much more can the left or the West just, well, it might be the same thing, but how much more can the West just lean on its domination of the banking system to get what it wants politically? Is the banking system eternally an I win card for the left or for the West generally?
Yeah.
How could that even be?
I think it's mirrored in what we've seen in our own little circles where, you know, I was banned from Patreon a few weeks ago. And so now it isn't like Subscribestar. It isn't like Gab, where you've got like Andrew Torbach coming out and giving us hot takes on like Biden and or whatever it is. It's like Subscribestar is just a processor, and it isn't anything beyond that. It doesn't judge you on what your opinions are. It's just a tool, and that's the way that's great. That's what people want. So if the Americans are if the Western sort of banking system, now they are Patreon. So now you've got countries like China who've got an incentive to create the Subscribestar. that people can feel, well, it's just a tool to do business on. They've fallen straight into that trap. And it's really funny how we can see that we saw this, you know, a few years ago, where the kind of global homo platforms, who are all now, you know, banning themselves from Russia or whatever ridiculous stuff it is. So now it's like, well, they are now in the position, the other countries, if you want to have security, they'll build their own. They'll build their own version of BitChute and Subscribestar or whatever. Or, you know, Telegram's already theirs. They already had that. So,
I mean, that's going to happen. I think what we're going to see is the beginning of sort of a multipolar world order forming, because it needs to happen, because China and Russia understand that they have to have some pull to rely on. That's not the United States. But what really becomes interesting is when this sort of lost mandate of heaven, as I'm clumsily putting it here, when that becomes apparent to more and more of the intellectual Brahmin classes, and you have a distant intellectual movement that sort of erupts inside the West to a much larger extent than the small places we've seen it in our own circles. Yeah. And if that happens, then, you know, you could see the problems of Western governments metastasizing very, very quickly, because their confidence in being able to do anything will evaporate, and they'll become very, very paranoid very quickly. And that will kind of become, I think, it will sort of become a vicious cycle.
I mean, I do see, you know, on the horizon, especially in regards to Russia, which is one of the reasons you should be careful. I mean, Richard Spencer's now coming out on Twitter, and he is like sort of saying like it's going to be tough. All of these people who've gone all in on Team Russia, you know, like Nick Fuentes, I think, and there's some others. Like, basically, his point is that if this goes really bad, like, all of these people are people the system doesn't like in the first place. So now, on top of everything else, I mean, I think they called January the 6th. Did they say that was treason? Or
they charged a few people with sedition on very light evidence, too.
Yeah, so this I would expect to see treason laws, or maybe they'd word it slightly differently, especially in regards to foreign policy. The idea of being like pro-Russian misinformation is already telling you where they're going to go. They don't want this, where you sit in a Western country and you go on the internet or go on the streets and kind of openly declare for Russia, say, which many in our circles are kind of doing, to be honest. Like, they may very well just say you're a traitor and we're going to bring back some extremely harsh punishments for that.
But see, that's doing the very thing that, if you look in our white traitor category, Antigone and Sir Thomas More and all these people and the Diocletian Christians, they went to great lengths to make sure that they didn't do ostentatious self-promoting things like declaring for a foreign country inside a country you currently live in. You can't do that. Like, that's not proper. That indicates that this is about pride more than it is about following your conscience and following things that are a higher good than the temporal government. You, as a citizen of a country, have no right to declare for a foreign power, especially when your country is on the verge of war with that foreign power. But you, as a citizen of a country, can absolutely declare that the government of your country is mismanaging your country to the ultimate detriment of its own citizens and the ultimate detriment of the human race.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, I mean, I don't know. I think that, you know, once you start courting treachery in the explicit sense, and you're not in some incredibly hard situation like Magnus the Red or Robert E. Lee or potentially even Brutus, where you're just under the gun, once you just wake up in the morning and decide to sort of court a gesture that looks externally like treachery, even if it's not, you know you're doing something that's not proper. You know you're not acting with responsibility and with prudence.
Yes. So, I mean, the approach So if you're looking at the situation playing out and thinking, well, where do I stand on that? I don't want to be a traitor to my nation. I don't want to side with, I've got sympathy for the Ukrainians, but I can also understand the difficult position that Russia's been placed in because of sort of Western imperialism, not to sound like a leftist, but it kind of is. The one to go for is the white treason, if at all, I think, where you're kind of looking at a higher state of how the world came into this place, which is kind of what I've pitched for on this, yeah. I think.
I mean, you know, or if you really want to fight for Russia, then you have to make your break explicit like Robert E. Lee, right? You know, yeah. I mean, I don't think defection is, I think there's an honorable way to commit that, but it can't be done. And the problem is that when you do these declarations, even though they're benign and they're not treachery because you're not using the trust to betray the people in question, they're sort of transparently effeminate because they're sort of also transparently impotent. The only reason why they're not treachery is because they're too weak to aspire to treachery, right? But that being said, like, you know, if you're just somebody who's trying to wield conscience and try to live in truth, then again, you have to go back to what you're truly loyal to, your family, your people, God, holiness, truth, goodness, beauty. And then you just, as long as you're prudentially following that path and saying, I'm taking an action here that's the best way I can see towards these higher ends, and I'm going to stand on my principle, trying to cause as little chaos as possible in the process, I think you're fairly safe in all of this. And yeah. And if you do that, the leftists that call you traitor online, it's just going to sound so hollow, which it already kind of does, you know, even when they're doing it now.
Yeah, the kind of shitlib component are going to try and sort of get people to paint themselves into the black treason corner.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they want. They want you coming out and saying how much you hate your country. Again, the hypocrisy. You're talking about people who hate the entire history of the Western world and think it was inherently impressive and destroyed the world. Now it makes your mind spin. It really does.
They like things that look like black treason. Like January the 6th, in my mind, was not treason. It was just rioting. It was basically a sin of incontinence, as Dante would put it. But January 6th was a bunch of boomers who lost their shit and chimped out on the Capitol and just rioted for fun. But in the process of doing that, they did something that looked like black treason, right?
Yeah.
They stormed the Senate chambers, right? And in that moment, if you got a picture at the right angle, you know, it looked like they were attempting to pull off a Brutus and Cassius on the Senate floor, quite literally. And so, you know, the media doesn't need you to actually be guilty of high treason or black treachery. They just need you to look like you're that. And you know, for what they are right now, they just want this optical moment. And I don't know. You have to be really careful not to give that to them.
I agree. So thank you very much. This has been a great conversation. Maybe in the future we can do another one where it's just purely about treason and treachery within fiction or something like that. But I think this was a good and fresh topic to get into, something different, which I've really enjoyed. So thanks a lot for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
All right. Cheers. I'm going to stop recording.